And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Kara Platone, who's the author of We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time. This might be the longest title we've ever had for a book, Lynn. It's pretty long. It's interesting book, though. So how do we know what's real anyway? Well, it's not a trick question. Sensory science is increasingly finding that we don't perceive reality. We create reality through perception. In We Have the Technology, Kara Platone guides us through the latest developments in the science of sensory perception. And this quote, Lynn, is fascinating. We don't perceive reality, we create it through perception. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Alex Travis, PhD, Associate Professor of Reproductive Biology at Cornell University. For the first time, a litter of puppies was born by in vitro fertilization, thanks to work by Cornell researchers. A total of 7 puppies were born. 2 from a beagle mom and a cocker spaniel dad, and 5 from 2 pairings of beagle moms and dads. Now, the breakthrough described in a study published online December 9th in the Journal of Public Science, Public Library, that is, of Science One, opens the door for conserving endangered canid species using gene editing technologies to eradicate heritable diseases in dogs and for study of genetic diseases.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
The Spur and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open Wednesday through Saturday nights with dinner, drinks, and live music. The SpurBarAndGrill.com includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. This is John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Before we start this morning, we just want to mention once again that at the canyons there was a 3-car accident heading southbound. If you don't have your compass with you, that means heading towards Park City. And we understand that it is causing havoc all the way back to Kimball Junction. After our first interview, we'll try to get an update for you and get that on the air. But again, there's a 3-car accident at the canyons heading south as you head towards Park City, and it's backed up all the way to Kimball Junction. Our first guest this morning, Kara Platone, we are not able to get on the phone with us this morning. So we're going to go to a fascinating interview that Lynn and I did a while ago, and we're going to speak with the interviews with Jerry Kaplan, author of Humans Need Not Apply. And after billions of dollars and 50 years of effort, researchers are finally cracking the code on artificial intelligence. As society stands on the cusp of unprecedented change, Kaplan unpacks the latest advances in robotics, machine learning, and perception-powering systems that rival or exceed human capabilities. Jerry Kaplan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you, John.
Yeah.
Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello, Jerry. We're not talking about about Terminators with robot armies and things like that. We're talking about a much more subtle type of arrangement with technology. And maybe you can start by just telling us a little bit about what we may see in the way of synthetic intellects or sensors and actuators or forged laborers.
Sure. Well, the issue here is developing new technologies. They're going to have some significant and potentially negative social effects. And so basically what I talk about in my book, Humans Need Not Apply, is some of the basics of these types of artificial intelligence technologies where we're beginning to equip robots with, to speak informally, the ability to see and to hear. And as a result, we can now use these types of technologies to perform tasks that to date required human attention and human labor. So we're going to see a hollowing out of the labor force in a way that we really haven't experienced before.
Yeah. And it's happening so quickly, it's going to be more difficult for us to adopt.
That's exactly right. Nothing's new about automation. That's gone on for a long time, and that's the substitution of capital for labor. But the fact is that what I see happening in the laboratories and universities, the research that's going into artificial intelligence, is we're seeing we're enabling new and advanced types of automation. And that's going to accelerate the pace at which people are put out of work or the way in which the labor force changes. Now, overall, that's a good thing because we're generating more wealth and ultimately everything will be just fine. But there may be an extended period of social turmoil in between as people are put out of jobs and don't have the skills that are necessary for the kinds of new jobs that are going to be created in the future.
Right. Lynn and I both live in Park City. I drive around or ride a bike, you know, that sort of thing. But I haven't used Uber before, and I was in Boston recently, and I decided, you know, I'm going to check this out. I've heard a little bit about it. And so I had 4, 5, 6 Uber rides, and for the most part, the people had been hired in the last, probably a couple of months. They were pretty new. They had upgraded their vehicles. They'd put some money in so that they could meet the Uber standards, and they were really singing the praises of Uber and what it could do for them. I don't think any of them knew that like 8 to 10 years from now, they won't be working for Uber.
That is exactly correct, John. You make a very good point. Uber anticipates hiring, I've seen figures as high as 500,000 drivers worldwide over the next few years. But what many people may not realize that in the interest of making taxi travel safer and less expensive, they're also investing tens of millions of dollars in projects to promote automated automated driving, self-driving cars. Now, when you have that technology, that's just as likely to see that 500,000 people put out of work. And that you may be looking at a time horizon for that somewhere in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, those people can get other jobs, perhaps, but it puts downward pressure on the labor market. It puts people out of work and reduces wages. And that's one of the two main societal problems that we're going to see as a result of developments in artificial intelligence.
Well, from Uber drivers to, as you say, and as we've been accustomed to for many decades now, you know, human labor forces being aced out by automation. Talk about some of the sort of highest level white collar jobs that you'll see going away with the, onslaught of artificial intelligence.
Lynn, you're asking exactly the right question. Sometimes you think, well, these are going to start with the low-level jobs and, you know, the laborers and the people who, pick crops and fields, and that's true. But the broad applicability of developments in artificial intelligence covers an incredibly big, wide range of human activities. And so, for example, as you may be aware, the so-called Watson technology that's developed by IBM, they're tackling the problem of medical diagnosis. So one of the areas that's going to see a significantly increased impact of automation is the medical profession. The same is true. It's already causing significant problems in labor markets for the legal profession. And the issue here is not you take a doctor and you throw him out of the building and you roll in a robotic doctor and he examines you. that's the kind of the mythology that really leads us astray in understanding this problem. What we're talking about is automating a wide variety of the more routine tasks doctors and lawyers and other professionals perform. And what that does is it leverages those professionals and makes them more productive, which, looked at from a different perspective, means that you don't need as many of them, and many of them wind up out of work.
Yeah, good point. Okay. So as you're mentioning the Watson technology, my mind goes to, forever we will hear that medicine is an art, not a science. And if you can just plug in, all of your symptoms, or if a doctor can do that, or if you can do it at home and it spits out this diagnosis, you still need that intuitive part. But you're saying that at least in the short term, that's not threatened. The intuitive part of medicine is not threatened.
Well, actually, I would politely take issue with you, Lynn, if I'm
please do
that on the radio. The main application of this technology will be for more routine kinds of activities. That's
okay,
true.
Yeah.
But medicine is not an art. That's nonsense. It's a science. And the more science we bring to it, and the more analytic techniques that we can use to help diagnose people, the better. Now, right now, it's certainly true that the best way to do that may be for a doctor to examine you and use it, that person's his or her experience in trying to diagnose whatever problem you've got. But that may very well be subject to analytic solutions in the future, which are far more effective. And indeed, that's what they find when they apply systems like IBM's Watson. They do a better job on things like planning cancer therapies and discovering new drugs and doing all kinds of other activities. You'd say, well, God, this is all creative and it requires intuition. Well, that's nonsense. It doesn't. And we're much better off developing machines that can do a better job at these kinds of activities than humans can.
Interesting. Can I take issue with you right back at you?
Of course.
Well, and I just wanted to point out, however, that if you're practicing, what is called integrative medicine, then you are looking not just at the symptoms, and you're looking at the whole person, which is kind of what I think I mean by intuitive medicine and maybe being more of an art than a science. You're looking at the whole person in terms of their mental health and physical health and their environmental health and that sort of thing.
The way you define it, Lynn, you persuaded me.
okay. Well,
if you look at it from that perspective, I think you're absolutely right. The fact is that what a doctor can do that today we don't have machines that can do is to look at the whole patient, look at a much broader context. In fact, if you think about the nature of automation, typically what it does is it's very narrow and it plays to certain kinds of tasks, but it can do that often far better than a human being can do for narrow kinds of tasks. Whether we will ever have machines that are capable of the same kind of broad understanding and diagnostic abilities of a Dr. House, if you've seen the show.
Love him.
I don't really know whether we're likely to see that. But it kind of misses the point.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, we don't need to worry about this.
Right.
The truth is, this is going to dramatically affect labor markets for doctors and for people who dig ditches for a living.
Jerry, there are a number of people, including yourself, that I would call futurists, that are talking about where this may go. And we, of course, really don't, because every time we try to predict the future, we're typically amazed at what can actually happen. But people look at what some of the futurists are saying, and they say, I'll tell you why it's not going to happen is because computers will only do what they're programmed to do. And that's just not true. I mean, today, machine learning and perception processing systems and those sorts of things, technology is going to be able to take off on their own, be able to do their own learning and evolve on their own over time. Can you talk about that?
Well, John, I totally agree with what you're saying. In fact, I tell the backstory in my new book, Humans Need Not Apply, about where that phrase came from, that computers can only do what they're programmed to do. It's an amazing story. And
right.
If I just try to quickly run this down for you.
Sure.
It was in the late 1950s that there was the first conference on artificial intelligence that took place at Dartmouth. Now, shortly thereafter, a lot of the participants in that conference made overblown claims for what the field might do, and it began to leak out into the popular press, Scientific American, the New York Times. And now IBM was the leading computer company at the time, and they were their goal, of course, was to sell hardware, to sell computers to people. And they began to get objections from the customers. Word was coming back to headquarters, the salespeople in the field, that their customers were saying, my God, what if these machines take my job? This is all very frightening, and it was an impediment to making the sale. So they armed their sales force, IBM armed its sales force, with answering this objection by saying, just tell people the computers can only do what we program them to do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did that, and they shut down their internal department that was doing research in artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
Now, IBM has since come around, but the truth is that the types of programming that was being done 30 or 40 or 50 years ago is very different than the kind of programming that's done today. Even when I learned to program, it was do this, then do that. That's how you instructed a computer to perform a task. Today, new techniques in the area of machine learning and neural networking are really very different, because what you do is instead of telling it how to solve a problem, you give it examples of successful solutions. And the machine itself, the way the programs work, is it learns how, on its own, how to perform those tasks and how to accomplish the tasks that you're trying to program it to do.
Yeah.
So the plain truth is, computers are capable of a far broader range of activities and accomplishments than people today realize.
Yeah, I mean, a typical Fortran statement was, if this, then that. It was so specific. And today, you basically say, computer, go out on the internet, find something, figure it out.
That's exactly correct. In fact, Google itself is a major leader in the area of machine learning. And if you watch how it responds to your queries, your search requests, if you use Google, you'll see that it's slowly adapting and understanding what you want and how you like your results presented. That's machine learning, and that's what they're doing at Google.
If you were just joining us, we're speaking with Jerry Kaplan, who is a technology luminary from Silicon Valley, written a fascinating book, Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Well, it seems to me to make sense that Google is now restructured or will be restructuring under Alphabet, and we'll be able to tell Wall Street or show Wall Street what some of these moonshot businesses are and how they're developing. What do you think of this announcement?
Well, I think they're just trying to restructure in order to make their company a little bit more transparent. I know that it's sort of this thing in the news, but I don't think it represents some kind of significant change in what's actually, who's going to work there and what they're actually doing there.
Yeah.
I applaud them for doing it, but it's mostly to satisfy the investors in Wall Street who were getting concerned that they were diffusing reducing their profitability by diffusing their investments across a broad range of activities that didn't seem related to the core business of the company.
Yeah, with tons of cash that was disappearing on a monthly basis that was going towards these moonshots, and people didn't know how to account for it.
Absolutely. Barrels of cash.
Mm. Jerry, I want to ask you about this really interesting part of your book where you talk about moral agency and how we program our computers, or if we ever can achieve that. And you talk about moral agency morality, and you compare maybe a computer to a psychopath. And you say, while a psychopath lacks empathy, still they know how to operate within a structure. They're aware of the structure, and they can either choose to operate within it or outside of it. Talk a little bit about how you compare and contrast that with a computer, with artificial intelligence.
Well, it's a great question. In my Humans Need Not Apply, I discuss this issue of moral agency in considerable detail. Now, the cool thing about moral agency is we ourselves have some intuitions or feelings that guide our behavior to social norms and to engage in ethical behavior. But it's important to understand that machines, there's just no corresponding notion for a machine. So as you put it, machines are natural psychopaths. They don't have any of that kind of human restraint that people do. So when we set them to work on a task, they're going to abide by the types of social conventions that people naturally take for granted. As a result of that, with the growing capabilities of these machines, one of the many projects that we're working on at Stanford University, where I'm a lecturer, is to figure out how to imbue computers with the ability to make a morally appropriate decision. And we don't really have good theory about that, but the important point is, just like psychopaths, the machines don't have to be sentient. They don't have to feel what's right or what's wrong. They just have to behave based upon these sorts of principles. So there's a whole new area of programming called moral programming, or computational ethics, that is concerned with how to make this into an engineering discipline so that the types of machines that we're going to be dealing with will behave in the ways we want them to. This is going to become particularly important when we have self-driving cars.
Oh, yeah. Well, you give the example of a self-driving car and say, if you would want to say, you know, there's going to be something that runs out in the middle of the street, and whether it's a dog or an elderly couple or a bunch of children chasing a ball, you know, how will they be programmed as artificial moral agents to choose which one to either save your life and hit or compromise your own life as the passenger of the car? So interesting.
Exactly. And there's some very difficult moral issues that come up in this context. You might think, well, let's just program it to obey the rule. But that doesn't work, because if a child runs out in the street to get a ball and you're in your car, you will swerve, say, to the left across a double yellow line in order to avoid that child. Everybody knows that that's the right thing to do, and nobody would question that.
Right.
But if you were to program a car that just said, don't cross a double yellow line, it'll run over the child. So these are very important questions, and we can't just all of the cases. We need to have a theory and an engineering discipline to figure out how to imbue computers with these sorts of social conventions.
It makes me want to not step inside of an autonomous car just yet.
Except that your life will be much safer inside that car than it will inside that Uber vehicle that John was talking about in Boston.
It'll be safer, it'll be less expensive, and frankly, when you step in your car today, you have ABS brakes, and they're not called robots, they're called brakes, but they're basically making many decisions for you in a microsecond. Every time you touch the brakes. Every time you touch the brakes. You know what I got a kick out of, Jerry, was, you know, there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are taking these technologies and they're quietly incorporating them, bringing them into their businesses and what they're doing. And they're not really talking about the technical aspect of the contribution that technology is making. But you mentioned a law firm, Robot and Wong, who that he's basically saying, hey, listen, I'm using technology. And the name of his law firm is Robot and Wong.
That's true. Of course, he meant it as a little bit of a joke, but he's still a practitioner that uses a lot of computer technology. And I think he was making a good point. Most of the work that's done at law firms largely is done by computers. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff that lawyers do is routine, drafting contracts and doing leases and things like that. And a lot of that work can be done, can be automated. And it's affecting the legal profession right now to a very great degree and is causing employment problems for lawyers.
And I hate to quote from books, or I don't hate to, but I don't do it very often, but I'm just going to do it really quickly. Lynn and I are both Alan Turing fans, so I'm going to give you a short Alan Turing quote, and then I'm going to give you, everybody, a Jerry Kaplan quote. So on the original questions, can machines think, Alan Turing said that by the end of the century, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines without expecting to be contradicted, thinking machines. And you paraphrase and you take that that original quote, and you are saying that you predict within 50 years' time, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of synthetic and intellects as alive without expecting to be contradicted. Tell us about that statement and about synthetic intellects.
Well, I use the term synthetic intellects in the book to distinguish it from another term, which is forged laborers, which are basically machines that do things. Synthetic intellects, to me, are just programs that engage in some kind of intellectual behavior. So just as our language has shifted, and this was, I think, Turing's point, contrary to what people think he meant by the Turing test, what he was talking about was that by approximately the year 2000, people would be able to use the word think when it comes to a computer, and they wouldn't think that was weird. And indeed, that has happened. Oh, you know, the computer's thinking about what to do. Mostly we say that when it's just, you know, spinning, doing nothing. So in terms of language shift, I think people will regard these machines that we're going to have within 50 years, they'll think of them as being alive, not exactly in the same sense that animals are alive or plants are alive, but I think that our language will shift in the same way that it has for the term think, so that what it means to be alive will include a large swath of mechanical devices.
Very interesting. Jerry, a quick question before we let you go. Stanford
Sure.
University, one of the best computer science programs in the country. If you know, we think of someone who's coming to a place like Stanford to learn programming as possessing these certain characteristics, perhaps. But how do you think it's going to morph the program, or how has it already? I mean, are you going to be enlisting the support of more touchy-feely, intuitive thinkers who can program artificial intelligence and intuitive synthetic intellect?
The short answer is yes, and actually at Stanford, and it's sure it's happening at lots of universities. The level of integration between people doing engineering work in artificial intelligence and people in the philosophy department, people who are studying ethics, people who are studying what's called human-computer interaction, HCI, people who deal with studying affect, the expression or the recognition of human emotion by machines, there's a much broader range of academics and professionals and disciplines that are slowly beginning to coalesce to make sure that this new technology that we're developing in the lab serves humanity in positive and beneficial ways. And really, I cover a lot of this in my book, Humans Need Not Apply. And if you'd like more detail, I refer you to the text.
Humans Need Not Apply, A Guide to Wealth and Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Jerry Kaplan has written a book for the layperson, which not only covers the technology and where it's going, but some of the challenges that we're going to have, including the chasm between the haves and the have-nots, which could potentially widen in the beginning until we figure out how to adopt all of this and to make the social changes required. Anyway, it's a really good read, Jerry.
Oh, thank you very much, John. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
And very best of luck to you on this book. I've very much enjoyed reading this. Recommend it to anybody. And thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Great. It's been delightful to talk to you both.
Okay.
Bye now. Again, Jerry Kaplan and Humans Need Not Apply. Interesting conversation. And we'll be back. We're able to get our guest, Kara Platone, on the phone, so we're excited to talk to her. But first, a quick traffic update, and that is the three-car fender bender, no injuries reported at Canyons. Still backing up traffic all the way onto Interstate 80 and Highway 40, apparently. So just avoid that area altogether. Lots of high emotions during this holiday season, and we've had everyone call from telling us what we're supposed to tell the police to do to what we're supposed to tell people how to merge better. And everyone, just take a deep breath and, I don't know, listen to our show. We've got a great guest coming up, and we'll be right back after this.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice, such as cleaning or replacing your air filters regularly and setting your thermostat to 68 degrees in the winter. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We've had a couple of changes, so let me just update you with what we're going to be doing. We are going to be speaking with Kara Platone, who's the author of We Have the Technology. And I'll give that introduction in just a moment. But then following that, about 10 minutes before the hour, we'll be speaking with Alex Travis, who's an associate professor of reproductive biology, Cornell University. And we'll be talking about, for the first time, a litter of puppies was born by in vitro fertilization, thanks to the work by the Cornell researchers. Well, Kara Platone has written We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time. And We Have the Technology introduces us to researchers who are changing the way we experience the world, whether creating scents that stimulate the memories of Alzheimer's patients, constructing virtual limbs that approximate a sense of touch, or building augmented reality labs that prepare soldiers for the battlefield. And these diverse investigations not only explain previously elusive aspects of the human experience, but also offers glimpses into the future when we can expand, control, and enhance our senses as never before. Kara Platone, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Kara, before we start, you have a master's degree from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and you teach reporting and narrative writing. How did you get on this crazy journey?
Well, I've been a science reporter here in California's Bay Area for, almost two decades now. And when I was out in the field, it occurred to me that people were talking about a lot of the same things. They were talking about the brain, they were talking about robots, and they were talking about wearable gadgets. And the more I traveled around in this world, I realized all of these things were kind of converging at a certain point, which was the idea of technologies that could alter or augment the way you experience the world. So once that all came together for me, I thought, yep, time to write a book.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are familiar with robots and drones and wearable technology, but I would bet that most of our listeners are not familiar with biohackers, also known as grinders, that modify their bodies to enhance the human experience. Tell us about this interesting group of people.
Sure. Well, there are some people who are kind of using themselves as an experiment to see if they can augment or alter their senses in some way. And I should say, this was kind of out of all of, I spoke to more than 100 different people for this book. So I went to military bases, I went to university labs, I went to speak with chefs in their kitchens, I went to see perfumers in Paris, I went all over the world. But one of the coolest things was going to see these groups of biohackers who are trying to see if they can do something new with their bodies. One of the very popular things that people do is see if they can implant a magnet in their hand. And this is kind of a bid to see if they can use it to sense electromagnetic fields. I particularly hung out with this group in Pennsylvania, Grindhouse Wetware, that has built a number of different devices that work with an implanted magnet to see if you can do something else in addition. So when I was there, they had just built a device called the Circadia that was to see if they could port temporary information from their body to their telephone.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. How much success are they having with this? And are they getting people that are, you know, waiting in line to sign up?
Yes, there are actually people waiting in line to sign up. The Circadia device that I saw, the guy who had it implanted only wore it for about 3 months and then took it out. But they have just implanted the first round of a new device called the North Star. The whole idea of the North Star is to see if they can make kind of a compass that would go in your hand, that would work with a magnet and light up when you face north. So they just, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, came out with the first edition of the North Star. This one doesn't have the compass element in it. It just lights up, but they just did it. And yeah, they have a list of people who would like to try these things.
Wow. And how does that make you respond? I mean, with many of these things that you speak about in your book, you've researched them. What's your opinion on especially things like biohacking?
Well, okay, so if you're asking me if I got a magnet for my hand, I did not. I chickened out. I got offered a lot of magnets, did not take anybody up on it. I think it's a really interesting field of endeavor. The reason it's so interesting to me is because these are people doing it themselves. They are free from a lot of the limits that would be on a university researcher or a for-profit company. You know, they don't have to get, they don't have to create a mouse model. They don't have to go through all of these ethics reviews and so on. That said, they take on a lot of risk, and they know it. They know that they are taking on a risk of infection, of really hurting themselves, of getting sick. So they're kind of a very, very specialized group. And in the book, I say very clearly, don't do this at home, kids. But it's interesting to know what they're trying to do. That said, the big question is, will any of it work? You know, does putting a magnet in your hand actually give you any additional sense? And there's no department at a university that you can go to ask an expert, because nobody's really studied this. But in my book, I do raise a hypothesis at the end. I think I came up with an answer that kind of addressed what all of the biohackers were telling me they could sense and experience with what neuroscientists understand of what they're doing, and came up with what I think is a good answer, what I really hope is a good answer.
Wow. You know, the word cyborg sort of elicits this vision of Star Trek Next Generation beings that have all this hardware integrated in them, and they've somehow lost their humanity. But in fact, the biohackers, they want more humanity. The future is about enhancing the human experience. And I wanted to ask you about the motivation for these folks. Do they believe that their bodies are limited, you know, that they can only see in the 400 to 700 nanometer range, and they want to see more, they want to feel more? Do they feel that their bodies, because some other animals in the animal kingdom, like birds and sea turtles and insects, even bacteria, have the ability to be able to sense magnetoreception, I think is what you call it.
Mm-hmm.
Is their motivation? Do they think their bodies have let them down?
That's exactly it. I think a lot of the people I talked to were pretty frustrated, actually, with the standard issue of the human body. So we have five sensory portals. We have touch, taste, smell, hearing, sight. And as you mentioned, other animals have other ones. You know, sharks can sense electricity. Pit vipers can see into the infrared. There are lots of animals that can sense magnetic fields. And when I would talk to the biohackers, they would say, why can we not sense gamma rays? Why can we not see ultraviolet? This is frustrating. We're so limited. And they would say it's just a human thing to want to improve your body. It's something that we've been doing ever since the invention of, you know, the sharpened flint and the fire. This is just what humans do. And as the whole cyborg argument, you know, a lot of people will argue that anything that you put on the naked body makes you a cyborg. I had people say, look, wearing clothes makes you a cyborg. Clothing is a technology.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought about a lot is I wear glasses. You know, nobody thinks you're a cyborg for wearing glasses, but those are a technology that augment your perception.
It's a technology that's also been totally incorporated into the human experience. If you think about fire and clubs and tools and language and words and now reading glasses and cochlear implants, there's been over 300,000 of those that help deaf people, and ask them if they ever think about those implants. They don't. It's totally integrated in their experience. What I'm curious about is we had somebody on that talked about the brain's ability to be able to map new devices that are introduced to the body, either in the body or outside of the body. And I was curious about the people that are doing this magnet thing in their hands. Why wouldn't they just wear some tight-fitting gloves that have all the magnets incorporated? Because apparently the body is the brain is supposed to be able to sense these external things and be able to incorporate them into the human experience. Why would they have to do something as invasive as cutting themselves up and sliding all these magnets in?
Yeah, I asked some people about this very question. One of the things that some early biohackers implanted is an RFID chip. So that's a radio frequency ID tracking chip. It's what you might have in your car if you have a bridge toll pass. Yeah, or it's what people use to chip their pets in case their pet gets lost. And I said, why not just have this thing on a card? Why do you have to have it in your hand? And people will use them to open doors, to turn on computers. I met a guy who used it to start his motorcycle. And he and the people who had magnets said, when it's part of your body, it just becomes part of your abilities. It becomes part of the way you think about yourself on a daily basis. It just becomes part of your life. And if you took it away, they said they would feel bereft. They would feel a real loss. It had just become part of their body. It's exactly what you were talking about, this kind of idea that the body can assimilate information that it's being given. The term is plasticity. When it's incorporated into the body, it becomes a real part of your sense of self.
Mm. Well, maybe this cyborg stuff doesn't appeal to you, but, you know, maybe unlocking the sense of smell for someone in your family who may have Alzheimer's. This is so interesting. There's a lot of practical application in your book, as well as just all these wild and zany things, which is why it's such a great book. But talk a little bit about mapping with technology the sense of smell, unlocking it.
Yeah. So my idea for this book was that each chapter would be a story about somebody in the real world doing some kind of science that has to do with expanding or altering or really understanding a sensory experience. So one of the things I got to do that was really cool was I went to a hospital in Paris where a group of women who are from the cosmetics industry were using scents to help people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. And one of the first clinical signs of Alzheimer's is loss of the ability to smell. And don't panic, because everybody's sense of smell degrades a little bit over a lifetime. But it gets harder for people to distinguish between one scent and another. And the women in this group thought, what if we bring in smells, very French smells usually, that would have pleasant associations for a person born and raised in France, and we use them to help people recall memories and talk about them? Because one of the things that can happen with advanced dementia is people become very withdrawn. They have a hard time recalling words, communicating, identifying people. So they go in and they have these blotters, paper blotters, like the kind you find at a perfume counter, and they dip it in a scent and they wave it under the person's nose, and then they have a conversation about it. These very sweet ladies would probably not think of themselves as biohackers, but in a weird way, they are finding a kind of a neat temporary, not solution, but kind of a bit of respite for a really serious medical problem.
Wow, fascinating. There's so many things in this book that, as you say, each little vignette holds a different sort of piece of technology that's either useful, you know, or not, but interesting just the same. Cara Platone, thank you so much for joining us. Wish we had more time this morning. It's been a bit of a crazy morning around here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice to talk to you.
All right. Bye now. Again, that book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception, One Sense at a Time. You going to get some magnets implanted into your hands?
No, I don't believe I will. But I like the idea of the external and being assimilated, because the brain mm-hmm. will recognize it over time. So that'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about in vitro puppies when we return.
Hello, Park City. I'm Joe Simmons with Park City High School and the Minor Nation Report. Listen every Monday for the latest in high school sports and activities. The Minor Nation Report is made possible in part by UPS Stores, Rich Fine Realtor, Elliott Work Group, and Miller Orthodontics.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Cara Platone, author of We Have the Technology. Our next guest is Alex Travis. He's associate professor of reproductive biology at Cornell University. For the first time, a litter of puppies was born by in vitro fertilization, thanks to work by Cornell researchers. Well, gene editing technologies can now be used to eradicate heritable diseases in dogs, and for study of genetic diseases, Dr. Travis is going to join us to tell us all about that. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So, you know, as I was reading through your article and your study, I thought maybe we should just have you explain, first of all, how in vitro fertilization is performed. We all know a little something about it, but maybe not all.
Right. So it's It's an easy technique, and we take eggs from a female and sperm from a male, and literally put them together in a drop of fluid in a dish, and the sperm fertilize the egg, produce an embryo, and then in this case, we then froze these embryos for storage until we could have a surrogate mom come into heat and cycle, and then we transferred them into her after thawing them out. So conceptually, it's pretty straightforward, and it's been done in people since the mid-1970s.
So you say that dogs have 350 similar heritable disorders. That's similar to other breeds of dogs?
Well, actually, they have 350 different genetic diseases predispositions to disease and traits that have direct similarity to the human condition. And that's almost twice as many as any other species that we know.
Okay. So it makes me curious about why you took, a beagle mom, a cocker spaniel dad. I mean, aren't there those kinds of dogs breeding all over the place?
Oh, absolutely. And that's probably the biggest misconception or the biggest problem with this is really why we did it initially is for endangered species conservation. And we have to save different species like the African painted dog, the red wolf from North America. These animals are critically endangered with extinction, and we need assisted reproductive technologies to help preserve them in captivity and save the genetic diversity that we have now. It's not necessarily just a technique to make more puppies, because as you say, we have lots of puppies. But the other thing from a scientific perspective, it also gives us access to those embryos. And with new gene editing technologies, we can then go in and try to fix some of those 350 diseases that you mentioned. And that's really then it's a combination of this, which allows you to produce an embryo, and that new gene editing technology that gives us now really a very unprecedented access to looking at the cause of genetic disease and how we can fix it before it starts.
Mm.
Dr. Travis, when you talk about the heritable disorders, the 350, is that from overbreeding or is that from just problems that exist like hip dysplasia?
Well, that's a great question, and that's it's a combination. In some cases, people, we've created over centuries these different breeds of dogs to perform different jobs for people, whether it's herding sheep or guard dogs, or look different ways. And in selecting for those traits, sometimes unwanted genetic baggage is linked with those traits that people want, and these predispositions to disease come along with it. In other cases, people do breed specifically for traits that actually are themselves illnesses and cause problems for those breeds. Mm. Those are, in a sense, more difficult to challenge because people are actively selecting for those. We're looking here at using the combination of in vitro fertilization to produce embryos with gene editing to knock out those diseases that are unwanted and are really just genetic baggage coming along.
Right. And Dr. Travis, gene editing is such a hot topic right now. Is this also an opportunity to be able to try different things that we may not necessarily want to try on humans at this point?
Oh, absolutely. Gene editing is a new technology. There's still an awful lot that needs to be done and learned in that. I myself am not an expert in gene editing, more of a reproductive biologist. But definitely there are things that you want to do in animals first before you move to people. And in the case of the dog, it's actually been used as a model before for gene therapy. And in one famous case, work done here at Cornell and also University of Pennsylvania, scientists identified a gene that caused an inherited form of blindness. They used gene therapy to restore sight in a dog, and then nowadays that has been done in people as well. So this idea of using the dog and all these genetic diseases they get as a model for people is actually something that works and improves both dog health and human health.
Hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I read this, since the mid-1970s, researchers have tried to perform this in vitro fertilization among dogs, and they haven't been able to. But in vitro fertilization's been around for a long time in humans.
Oh, yes. And this is really one of the interesting things, because although they have all these genetic traits that are similar to people, in terms of reproduction, they're really different from other mammals, especially people. So that's different on the female side in terms of when they ovulate an egg into the fallopian tube or oviduct, it comes out at a very immature stage compared to other species. And so I think for decades people thought, well, if we could just mature them up to the point where we're at the same stage that humans are, or mice or other species where we do IVF, then those eggs should be ready to be fertilized. And actually, it turned out that wasn't the case. They needed extra time to mature.
Oh, that's pretty fascinating. So it was just that little tweak, and you got it.
Well, that little tweak on the female side, and then on the male side, there was another tweak, too. You know, sometimes if things don't work for 40 years, it's a good lesson to, you know, go back to the drawing board. And we looked at some of the early papers that said how to handle dog sperm, and one of them actually... Now looking back at it with 40 more years of knowledge, we realized that we would interpret some of their data a little differently. And so we added magnesium to the fluid that we used to prepare the sperm to be able to fertilize. And that was really a tremendous lesson. Our the first author on this paper, Jennifer Nagashima, is the first graduate student in a new training program between Cornell and the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. And it was a lesson for her and for all scientists and young students. You know, go back to the drawing board and really look at things carefully.
Interesting. Is there any science that shows that taking additional magnesium supplementation improves the health of human male sperm?
You know, I don't know about that. In this case, magnesium at these concentrations is usually around in say, bodily fluids, serum in your blood. But in this case, it was left out specifically to help the sperm head interact with the egg. But in fact, it had the exact opposite effect. And so we had some studies that in the paper that showed that the sperm weren't really able to fertilize unless it was present.
Wow. Fascinating work and congratulations. It's really interesting. And what's the next step real quickly?
So there's two next steps. One is at the Smithsonian, Jennifer is continuing to work on now developing ways to mature eggs from ovarian tissue, if from endangered species that might die and we collect some ovarian tissue. And then on the male side, we still need to do some work on sperm and then hopefully use these techniques to help save endangered species.
Wow. Dr. Alex Travis is Associate Professor of Reproductive Biology at Cornell University. Dr. Travis, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Interesting work. We'll be right back after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio today. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with John Wells. I want to thank our guests today, Jerry Kaplan, Humans Need Not Apply, Kara Platoni with the book We Have the Technology, and most recently, Dr. Alex Travis of Cornell University. I want to also thank our underwriters, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City. It's time now to head into National Public Radio News from Washington. You're listening to KPCW Park City.